This is VOA's International Edition. President Obama rolls out new gun control actions. A new report blasts jihadism for its attacks on press freedoms. New hope for those suffering with muscular dystrophy. A 12-year-old pianist wows the jazz world.
Joey plays a version of Around Midnight, and everybody's jaws dropped, like looking at Joey, like I can't, and leaning forward and looking at each other, and they're like laughing, like this can't possibly be.
These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. President Obama Tuesday outlined his initiatives to curb gun violence during an impassioned address, saying people are dying and the constant excuses for inaction no longer do. Surrounded in the White House East Room by gun violence survivors, the families of those killed by firearms, gun control advocates, and some prominent lawmakers, Mr. Obama sharply criticized Congress for failing to pass stricter gun control measures. According to the White House, firearms claim the lives of more than 30,000 Americans in mass killings, suicides, domestic violence, and other incidents each year. Mr. Obama announced a series of executive actions aimed to tighten enforcement of the existing gun laws, increase mental health treatment, and expand research into gun safety technology. The issue is generating bitter debate and dividing the American public. Critics argue the measures will do nothing to reduce gun violence. Philip Cook, professor of public policy at Duke University, is author of a recent study into how criminals in the United States tend to acquire guns. He talked about it with International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
The article was specifically about a survey that I conducted in Cook County Jail, which serves Chicago. We talked to about 100 inmates there about their life with guns and asked them in particular about where they had gotten their most recent gun and under what circumstances. But I've also done a series of other studies on the same topic and using other data sources. I think that it's fair to say that the answer is consistent that comes out of especially the survey data with criminals, and that is that it's very unusual for them to get their gun by going to a gun store. And in fact, probably nationwide, at least 90% of them say that they are getting their guns from acquaintances, from family members, on the street, from a gang, and other informal sources that are largely unregulated.
Well, the White House today, and President Obama specifically, announced a series of executive orders to try to get some control over the use of guns in the country in response to several mass shootings. They described it as common sense measures, trying to require gun sellers to get licenses, more gun buyers to undergo background checks. Is this a trickle-down kind of effect?
I think that President Obama's proposal would help regulate more of the sales that occur online and in gun shows. Those are not important sources for robbers and gang members directly, but it's quite possible that in some jurisdictions they are a source of guns to gun traffickers and to the people that supply the underground market. So I think that it's a small step, but it's in the right direction for trying to increase the scarcity of guns.
Is it a situation in the United States where there are just so many guns available that legislation may not be enough to stop it?
Well, I think that what we know is, first of all, there are an extraordinary number of guns in circulation in the U.S. There's something like 300 million, which is enough for every man, woman, and child to have one. But that's not how it works. In fact, only about one quarter of the adult population in the U.S. owns a gun. The ones who own one gun tend to own five or six. And so it's a very kind of concentrated phenomenon. But what I would say is that the regulations that we have in place, weak as they are, do some good. And that has been documented by, for one thing, for evaluation of circumstances where a state, for example, has repealed a regulation requiring a background check and experienced then an increase in their gun homicide rate as a result. I hear from many people that there's nothing to be done because there's so many guns, it's like grains of sand on the beach, but that's not actually true. The fact is that dangerous people have at some point to buy a gun or obtain a gun, and if we can make that more difficult, we can reduce the portion of their criminal career in which they are armed.
That's Philip Cook, professor of public policy at Duke University, whose article online is titled Criminals Acquiring Guns Through Social Connections. He spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Gun sales continued to surge in the United States in the 12 months before President Obama announced more rules for gun sales. According to federal law enforcement statistics, 2015 saw more Americans buying guns than ever before, with background checks surging 10% to 23.1 million. It was the largest number since the Bureau began keeping statistics in 1998. The trend's been going on for some time, but authorities caution that there is not necessarily a direct correlation between background checks and actual number of gun sales, as some background checks are conducted for gun permits, not the sale of a weapon. President Obama's speech on gun control is getting a lot of social media reaction. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us all about it. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray. As you can imagine, the World Wide Web is buzzing with passionate responses to the president's speech. Here's a brief recap. Mr. Obama called for a series of executive actions on gun control Tuesday. They include extensive background checks for potential buyers and new requirements to report lost or stolen guns in transit.
Well, no doubt there are plenty of responses to the controversial topic. Just about everybody has an opinion on this.
Oh, absolutely. So let's start with the White House. Its Facebook account shared a clip of the president's weekly address Monday and included this caption. Each time we're told that common sense reforms like background checks might not have stopped the last massacre or the one before that, so we shouldn't do anything. We know that we cannot stop every act of violence, but what if we try to stop even one? It used the hashtag #StopGunViolence.
What about some of the replies to that post?
Well, the first reply, and one of the most liked so far, reads like this. Thank you, Mr. President, for doing something about this and protecting our children. About time someone stands up to the NRA versus cowering and sticking their head in the sand. Even if it stops one attack, it's worth it. Our founding fathers didn't intend to have assault weapons flooding our streets and putting us all in danger. Time to fight back. That reply got more than 1,600 likes. Ray, now that we've checked out what the White House had posted on Facebook, it's time now to check out, you guessed it, the NRA's post. The National Rifle Association wrote this. President Obama met with his attorney general to discuss rolling out new executive orders on gun control. Too bad they won't do anything to make Americans more safe.
Well, that should be a rather controversial statement. Mm-hmm. It should call for some interesting replies.
It certainly did. The first person to respond asked a rhetorical question. Maybe he, referring to the president, should give up his Secret Service for him and his family. Why should he have the right to protect himself, but law-abiding gun owners can't? That comment got around 2,400 likes. Another person wrote, this isn't about protecting us. It's about protecting themselves from us. A disarmed nation is far easier to control. That's all for me today. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And on our program account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. Almost a year after deadly attacks on the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo in Paris, A new report by Reporters Without Borders calls jihadism among the world's worst predators of press freedom. The report is called Jihad Against Journalists. It summarizes efforts by Islamist armed groups such as Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and Al-Shabaab to intimidate and silence journalists and to repress the societies they cover. Spokesperson Margot Ewan shared details of the report with my colleague Susan Yockey.
We tried to trace back some of the origins of the increased violence that has been targeting journalists over the past couple of years. And we did note that there was a blacklist of 11 journalists, cartoonists, and intellectuals from Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine published in the spring of 2013 that actually included Stéphane Charbonnier, the cartoonist also known as Charb, who was Charlie Hebdo's publisher and one of the victims of last year's massacre on the 7th of January.
Do you have any details about what these organizations are doing specifically?
We do analyze specifically a lot of information with regard to Daesh, the Islamic State, because their propaganda is very sophisticated. They basically have two separate media strategies. One is to promote the organization and the benefits of joining it. The other is to use terrorizing tactics in video and online social media, showing staged executions, tortures, and military operations on behalf of their organization. In addition to taking local journalists hostage in the areas that they have taken over, they also gain immediate media attention when they detain or take hostage foreign journalists. And that can also serve as an important financial incentive for them as well to raise money based on ransoms.
You note 11 commandments for journalists from these organizations.
Yes. So the 11 commandments come from the Islamic State back in October of last year in the Syrian province of Deir ez-Zor. And it's kind of like an embryonic media law issued by Daesh. And some of those commandments forbid journalists from working for TV channels that are against Islamic State because, as we know, journalists are seen by the Islamic State as enemy combatants and they are to be targeted, which is a very radical escalation of violence against journalists that we hadn't seen on such an intense level before IS came into play. Another element from these 11 commandments is that journalists are not allowed to publish any article without first consulting the media office of Daesh. And the regulations are, of course, mentioned that they'll be subject to change under circumstances. So they are just guidelines, and ultimately the journalists who disobey ISIS will be left up to the fate of whoever is in charge of punishing them at that time.
Margot Ewan of Reporters Without Borders speaking with International Edition's Susan Yockey. Venezuela's opposition-dominated National Assembly was sworn in Tuesday, representing the first major political challenge to the socialist government of President Nicolas Maduro, the successor to the late Hugo Chavez. The socialists held the majority in the legislature in the South American country since 1999. The opposition elected veteran politician Henry Ramos as assembly president. The opposition won a majority in December's voting, but the Supreme Court last week barred the seating of three opposition and one socialist candidate following a government challenge of the results. There are concerns that protests by supporters of both sides could lead to violence. The University of Canberra Latin American analyst Luis Angusto Fernandez told International Edition's Victor Beatty it would be unfair to say there is an exceptional risk of violence in Venezuela.
This is certainly nothing new at all in the country. Venezuela, over the past 16 years, basically has been a country in which political demonstrations of all political inclinations are very common. And this is yet another opportunity in which we are going to see that citizens go onto the street to express their views on the national situation. If, as it is to be expected, people basically stick to their plans, what we are going to see is, I think, an expression of democratic behavior, constitutionally recognized right to go onto the streets and express one's views. And nothing particularly risky is going to be at stake at this stage.
Monday, the United States expressed its own concern. The government is trying to obstruct the actions of the National Assembly with regard to the delay in seating three opposition members. Does the U.S. have a legitimate concern?
This is something that should worry the United States or any other country. What at the moment is an institutional process of revisiting the results of a particular constituency within the country in which there are allegations of fraud in the undertaking of the elections. And I think the National Assembly shouldn't be affected by what is, for the time being, simply a temporary suspension.
On the eve of the National Assembly taking its seat, President Nicolás Maduro eliminated the National Assembly's control over nominating and removing central bank directors through a legal reform that the opposition has criticized as trying to curtail its power.
There is certainly, I think, a legitimate view that the president of Venezuela is trying to, of course, reshuffle a little bit its pieces within key government positions. This is a legal attribute that he has availing of. It is certainly, I think, the position or view that this is not totally legitimate, even if it is legal, in the sense that they feel that the position should be installed and the new opposition members should be able to express their views on these appointments and so on. But again, I think that this is not really extraordinary for any country in which the legislative body and the executive body have different terms, and there is always adjustments, of course, in the search for political advantage. Both powers seek to basically move their pieces when they can. It is legal. One, of course, can question, you know, the strength, the political strength that the president has at the moment overall. But institutionally and legally, he's in the right to do so.
Luis Augusto Fernandez also says he does not expect gridlock because of the country's pressing economic problems. The University of Canberra Latin American analyst was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Coming up, a young jazz pianist sensation. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
At an elder care facility in Pennsylvania, Alzheimer's patient Desi Assisi dances to 1940s-era music with her companion. The Easton home recently installed an old-time kitchen and living room to help enliven dementia patients. Dr. Jason Karlowish.
The benefits of reminiscence therapy is that it taps into memories that are well-learned, memories that are attached not just to a fact, but also to a smell, to images, to music.
The therapy is working for Olga Deacon, who has dementia. She often spends time in the kitchen telling stories of her childhood to her granddaughter, Chris Boyce.
I've learned more about her in the 2 months she's been here than I think I knew before that.
Caregivers say that reminiscence therapy won't alter the course of Alzheimer's or dementia, but it can improve mood and behavior by focusing on the patient's enjoyment of life. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition. Researchers have found what may be a permanent cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a disabling and eventually fatal genetic condition that affects boys. The new treatment essentially provides permanent repair of a mutated protein. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Duchenne muscular dystrophy, or DMD, is a relatively rare condition affecting approximately 1 in 5,000 boys worldwide. The disease causes the body to make a defective copy of a skeletal protein called dystrophin that holds the muscles together. The defective protein causes muscles to weaken and wither to the point that boys with Duchenne's end up in wheelchairs and usually die of heart or respiratory failure in their 20s and 30s. It's an X chromosome-linked disorder, meaning the defective gene that makes dystrophin is passed on to sons by their mothers. Girls have two copies of the X chromosome instead of one, so they're spared the disabling condition even if they inherit the genetic mutation from their mother. Using the so-called CRISPR gene editing technique, three independent groups of U.S. researchers literally cut out the defective portions of the dystrophin gene, so the remaining unaffected DNA was able to make healthy copies of the essential muscle protein. Rhonda Bassel-Duby is a molecular biologist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She was part of one of the teams that helped show that editing out the defective portions of the dystrophin gene stopped progression of the disease in mice.
We're able to cut in a very specific place, so it's directed cutting, and we're able to remove the mutant and hook it up in a way that you will be getting functional dystrophin being made.
The treatment only has to be performed one time for it to permanently halt progression. Basil Duby cautions that much more research is needed before CRISPR becomes a reality for treating DMD. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
A young jazz pianist from Indonesia is generating quite a following, getting rave reviews and 2 Grammy nominations for Best Improvised Jazz Solo and Best Jazz Instrumental Album. Joey Alexander is one of the youngest musicians to receive that honor. He is 12 years old. Heidi Chang has more.
When people first hear Joey Alexander play the piano, they are moved by his virtuosity and a bit surprised when they learn he's only 12. But don't think about his age, says Jason Olane, who produced Joey's debut album.
Just close your eyes and listen to Joey.
Josiah Alexander Sila was born in Bali, Indonesia, where his parents ran a travel business.
Well, my dad played a little bit of piano and guitar, but not that professionally. And then I saw him play, and he make me like, I want to play. Feels me like, I want to try this instrument.
When Joey was 6 years old, he learned to play jazz by ear, just by listening to his dad's record collection.
Duke Ellington and all these greats, Billy Strayhorn, Thelonious Monk, and Miles Davis, Coltrane, and Bill Evans. You know, I hope I hear all of these amazing musicians.
Joey's family moved to Jakarta so he could play with some of Indonesia's best jazz artists. When he was 10, he was invited to New York to play at Jazz at Lincoln Center, where Jason Olane is director of programming. Olane remembers the reaction of musicians who were there for a rehearsal when Joey performed a Thelonious Monk tune.
And Joey plays a version of Round Midnight, and everybody's, like, jaws dropped, like, looking at Joey, like, I can't, and leaning forward and looking at each other, and they're, like, laughing. Like this can't possibly be what we're hearing. He took another take afterwards, and it was a completely different arrangement. And again, everyone starts you kind of shrug your shoulders, look at each other, scratch your head, and just go, okay, all right, I've never seen this before.
One of the musicians who plays on Joey's debut album is drummer Ulysses Owens Jr. He's 32. Despite their age difference, Owens says they connected musically from the start.
You know, he has this thing that he does, you know, when he's really going somewhere. And I was just like, this is freaking amazing. You know, like, watching this little kid, he's going on all this all these harmonic adventures and melodic adventures and, you know, doing some really hip stuff. And he's just gone. You know, he's just completely in this next stratosphere. I'm like, that is a gift, man. You know, when I opened my eyes and I would look at him, that's what I saw. I was like, man, this kid is literally from another planet, and it's so beautiful to watch.
When he's not performing, the young pianist is homeschooled. He likes pop music, Michael Jackson, Aretha Franklin, and the Beatles.
You know, I'm still me as a kid, playing toys, and I play sports. Like, I play a little bit of tennis, swimming, like a normal kid, and then I watch movies.
Joey Alexander's parents gave up their travel business and eventually moved the family to New Jersey so Joey could pursue music. He says he's grateful for all the support and encouragement he's received along the way. And he's thrilled to be a part of the New York City jazz scene, where so many of his idols first made those recordings he grew up hearing, and where he can live his dream playing jazz for people.
I hope that they will feel the joy, because this music is so joyful and it touches people's hearts. And that's why, you know, when I play, I always hope, you know, people will, you know, be joyful, you know, in their lives and to have hope.
For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, is awarding more than $8.4 million in grants and cooperative agreements this year to support conservation projects and scientific studies that benefit coral reef management across seven U.S. states and territories, the Caribbean and Micronesia. All of these projects focus on priority coral reef regions and watersheds, addressing three primary threats: global climate change, land-based sources of pollution, and unsustainable fishing practices. Funded projects include grants to reduce sediment and improve water quality in U.S. Virgin Islands, work with communities in Hawaii to address threats to coral reefs, support coral reef ecosystem conservation in Puerto Rico, and strengthen outreach and education efforts. Projects also include work to assess coral reef resiliency to climate change in multiple locations. Earlier this year, NOAA declared the third global coral bleaching event. While corals can recover from mild bleaching, severe or long-term bleaching is often lethal, especially when combined with other threats. Healthy coral reefs are important to all of us. Conservation of these resources is a key factor in the resilience of coastal communities, said Jennifer Koss, director of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program. The projects funded through NOAA's grants program allow us to strengthen our ties with local partners, address the most pressing threats to corals, and broaden our conservation efforts. Nearly half of the funds awarded this year directly support coral reef conservation projects led by state and territorial resource management agencies. Other conservation projects are led by non-governmental organizations, community groups, and academic partners. A limited number of international projects focused in Micronesia, Mesoamerica, and the wider Caribbean region were also supported. It's exciting to fund smart and innovative projects led by partners who are working across disciplines to make a positive impact on the condition of the world's coral reefs, said Jenny Waddell, coordinator of the NOAA Coral Reef Conservation Program's grants portfolio. There are surely a lot of challenges ahead for coral reefs, but by studying, managing, and conserving them in a collaborative way, we are all helping to ensure coral reefs continue to survive and thrive.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.